Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in Ezekiel chapter 4, which I will entitle The Siege of Jerusalem Symbolized. Again, we are at 592/591 or so, 5 or so years into the second exile, the 590 exile of the Babylonians, caused by the Babylonians. The exile was, of course, of the Jews to Babylon. When Nebuchadnezzar came in and took Ezekiel and about 10,000 other people into Babylon, and Ezekiel was by the river Chebar when he received the vision of the whirlwind from the north that had the four living creatures in it with the wheels and the throne under the azure sky with a man looking like God, or God looking like a man, I should say, sitting in the throne. God spoke to Ezekiel, gave him his commission, and now we are in the middle of God speaking to Ezekiel. We begin now in verses 1 through 3 of chapter 4. Now, son of man, says God, take a clay tablet, put it in front of you, and draw the city of Jerusalem on it. Then lay siege to it, erect siege works against it, build a ramp up to it, set up camps against it, and put battering rams around it. Then take an iron pan, place it as an iron wall between you and the city, and turn your face toward it. It will be under siege, and you shall besiege it. This will be a sign to the house of Israel. Now this clay tablet would be a green clay tablet, one that's not fired. A fired clay tablet would not be easy to write on, but a raw clay tablet would be. And so Ezekiel is to draw Jerusalem on the clay tablet. Now, why did God ask Ezekiel to write upon a clay tablet? Here's some suggestions. Option number one, cities are built of brick, and this was a clay brick. Option number two, it was to show the weakness of the city of Jerusalem, how easily Jerusalem might be demolished, just like a clay brick could be broken easily. Option number three, to lead the Jews to reflect upon their making bricks in Egypt. I think that's sort of a stretch. Option number four, because the Babylonians had been used to writing upon tiles, they had celestial observations of a long course of years written on tiles. In other words, that was the common way to write back then, as all the archaeologists have discovered as they pull out all these tiles all the time, these clay cylinders and such. And so that just means that Ezekiel was to take what the common writing material was, and it didn't have any special significance. Well, I leave that for your consideration. I really don't care. Now, these bricks, or this tablet, as the NIV has it, other translations have bricks, like the Holman Christian Study Bible. Bricks commonly used in antiquity were 2 feet long, 1 foot broad, and 4 inches thick. So that's plenty of room for Ezekiel to draw a picture of Jerusalem on. Now in verse 2, God tells Ezekiel, lay siege to this Jerusalem that you've drawn on the clay tablet. Now the first question that arises is, does this mean to lay siege in his own person? Or does it mean to draw a siege upon the brick, as Benson, the commentator, says? Or it could be both. He's supposed to lay siege personally in his own person when he lay down in front of the clay brick, as we see later on in the chapter. He's supposed to lie down for 390 days and 40 days on his side, tied up. That's how he lays siege. But also, you have to assume that the laying siege to Jerusalem included drawing the things mentioned in verse 2. Siege works, ramp, camps, battering rams. How are you going to do that? God says, erect these siege works. Well, he did that by drawing on the clay tablet. Notice that the drawing on the clay tablets, including setting up camps against Jerusalem. I mean, Jeremiah was even supposed to draw tents where the Babylonians were camped outside the city. Now, in verse 3, God tells Ezekiel to take an iron pan and place it as an iron wall between Ezekiel and the city. Now, that symbolism is not obvious, and this has led there to be many different opinions from commentators. Here are some options. Option number one, the iron pan represented the hardness of the hearts of the people of Israel. Option number two, the iron pan represented the blackness of the sins of Israel. That's Benson's optional solution. Option number three, the iron pan represents the miseries of the Jews in captivity, because a pan is something in which things are fried, and the Jews were fried being in captivity. I think that's a stretch. Option number four, the iron pan represents the wrath of God against the Jews and God's resolution to destroy Jerusalem. Option number five, this is the one I favor, all such strong things as are made use of by besiegers to screen them from the besieged. Such strong things the Babylonians may have thrown up. Trenches, which I'm sure they did. I know they did. Parapets, which is a wall along the trench to protect the people in the trench. Bastions, which are angular fortifications along a horizontal wall so that you have a better line of fire on both sides of the angle. And more particularly, as Barnes suggests, a kind of shield set up on the ground behind which archers are shooting. That seems to sound like an iron pan. Here's another option that Ellicott likes and which Benson suggests as a perhaps option. Option number 6, the firmness and perseverance of the siege. In other words, there was going to be no escaping from the city to get through the iron plate. We go now to Ezekiel chapter 4, verses 4 through 6. God continues to speak to Ezekiel. Then lie on your left side and put the sin of the house of Israel upon yourself. You are to bear their sin for the number of days you lie on your side. Now, of course, Ezekiel could not have physically put the sin of Israel on his side. That's understood as he lay on his side that the sin of Israel was there. You are to bear their sin for the number of days you lie on your side. I have assigned you the same number of days as the years of their sin. So for 390 days you will bear the sin of the house of Israel. After you have finished this, lie down again, this time on your right side, and bear the sin of the house of Judah. I have assigned you 40 days, a day for each year. Now this lying down is to be done in Ezekiel's house. We know that from the last chapter, Ezekiel 3:24, the Spirit entered me. That's the Holy Spirit entered Ezekiel, and set me on my feet. He spoke with me and said, go, shut yourself inside your house. So this is in Ezekiel's house, somewhere near the river Chebar, that river that ran from Sarkisium at the Euphrates River on up to the Tigris River, translated as a canal in the Holman Christian Study Bible, because many people think that the Jews were used to help dig that canal. That's where Ezekiel lived. Now, the commentators divide on this question. Did Ezekiel actually lie down on his side in his house, or did he do it in a vision? In my opinion, he did it actually. Let's look at the reasons why some people think that Ezekiel lay on his side in a vision. The first reason, how could someone lie on his side for 430 days? Of course, that would be impossible. You'd probably die. As Benson says, though, the answer is that Ezekiel lay only during that part of the day when people might observe. That's when he lay on his side, during the daytime, when people might come in and see him. In fact, we're going to see later that people had to come in and untie him at night. Another reason why some people give that Ezekiel could not have lay on his side in actuality, bodily, for 430 days is because it would be so gross to have Ezekiel eating bread cooked by dung. Well, I don't think that's a good reason. That's not so gross that it couldn't be done. Besides, we see later that God relented of his requirement to cook over human dung and let Ezekiel change it to cow dung. So I'm going to assume that Ezekiel lay on his side in reality. Here are some reasons to back me up on that. First of all, the Jerusalem on the brick and on the iron pan, they were real enough, were they not? Well, first of all, the Jerusalem drawn on the brick and the iron pan between the brick and Ezekiel's head, they were real. They weren't in a vision, I don't think. There doesn't seem to be a break between the descriptions of the brick and the iron pan and further details of this so-called vision. However, some people think the brick and the iron pan were in the vision too, so that doesn't really prove my point. Another reason why I believe that this was Ezekiel actually lying down on his side was because the whole point of the symbolic action was to be a prophetic object lesson for the people. And that would be impossible if this were a vision. The people aren't going to get to see what Ezekiel and God are trying to tell them, because all of the relevant events would be in Ezekiel's head. Let me quote from the pulpit commentary, which backs me up totally on this. Quote, I adopt, without any hesitation, the view that we have here the record of a fact and not of a vision narrated. Close quote. Well, what is the symbolism here? As Adam Clark says, the symbolism stands for the oppression of the Jews. The Cambridge commentator says it stands for the house of Israel bearing the punishment for its sins. That's two quite similar ways of saying the same thing. Israel's being punished, basically, as we'll see. Now, in verses 4 through 6, we see Israel mentioned, and we see Judah mentioned. I'm going to say up front that Israel there is not Israel as a whole. That's the northern 10 tribes. Why? Because in verse 6, we have the house of Judah mentioned. So when you have the house of Israel mentioned right next to the house of Judah, it's obvious there's a distinction. The house of Judah is the southern two tribes, Benjamin and Judah. Now, Ezekiel is to lie on his side for 390 days looking at that iron pan, looking at that clay tablet. Now, this 390 days would be a great topic for two, maybe three PhDs in Old Testament. I have never seen such a split of opinion and such wild speculations as to what Ezekiel meant. I wrote down several of them in my notes, and I finally have said, nope, I'm not going to encumber my listeners with such speculation. I'm going to give you the best take on those 390 years that I found, which is from the commentator Ellicott. But before I do that, let's look at some general observations that apply to the 390 days and also to the 40 days of Judah also. First of all, it's years, not days. God explicitly says that. He says a day for each year in verse 6, so that's not controversial. We're not talking about days. Observation number 2. The period is one in which the Jews bear their iniquity. It's not the period of northern Israel's existence, or obviously not Judah's existence for the 40 years, but for the 390 years, some people have been tempted to say, ah, that refers to how long Israel existed. No, it's how long they bore their iniquity, as the Cambridge commentator and Ellicott quite accurately point out. General observation number 3. The period is connected with the siege of Jerusalem in 586. Ellicott points that out. Observation number 4. The periods are consecutive, as Ellicott points out. However, I will point out that this is debated a lot, so that's not so obvious, but it's at least arguable. Observation number 5. The 390 years refers to the past, not the future. Here's what Ellicott says about that. Every attempt to make these periods refer to a future time stretching on far beyond the date of the prophecy, fails for want of any definite event at the end of either 390, 40, or 430 years, when you combine 390 and 40. So you see the commentators have been working on that solution, and I don't like that, and Ellicott doesn't like it either. It doesn't refer to anything. Observation number 6, there is no satisfactory event to satisfy 390 years, past or future. Ellicott makes that point, and I think he's exactly right. So then, what does the 390 years refer to? Well, Ellicott gives what I think is a pretty elegant solution, although this is a difficult, difficult problem. Ellicott says that Ezekiel is referring to two well-known time periods in the Old Testament law, something that every Jew would have understood. The 40 years obviously stood for the 40 years in the wilderness, and the 430 years, when you add 40 and 390, you get 430. Those 430 years were reckoned as captivity in Egypt. So 40 and 430 would be two periods of times that had quite evil connotations in the Hebrew mind. Now, this captivity in Egypt, Exodus 12:40, the time that the Israelites lived in Egypt was 430 years. I'm going to tell you right now, that's a controversial time because the numbers don't add up. It has to do with the Hebrew translation, and it's probably calculated from the time of Abraham to the time of Joseph. I've gone through all of that in Exodus 12, and I'm not going to go into it again. But the point is that that number, 430, would have rung a bell with the average Jew, at least the one who had read his Torah. Now, the problem with that view so far is that God tells Ezekiel that northern Israel's punishment was to be 390 years, not 430. Ellicott's answer to that problem is this. Ezekiel did not want to make it look like northern Israel was suffering twice. If 430 years had been the number, northern Israel would have suffered for its own sins, and then they would have suffered another 40 years for Judah's sins. And so Judah's 40 years of punishment were subtracted out from the total, so that altogether there would be 430 years total punishment for the people of the Hebrews, both north and south. That might seem like a stretch, but believe me, that's much easier to understand than all the other speculations I read about and which I will not bore you with. Now, let's look at the 40 days that Ezekiel was to lay on his right side, symbolizing 40 years of punishment for the southern people of Judah. As Ligonier points out, 40 years represents a generation. We read in Numbers 32:13, the Lord's anger burned against Israel, and he made them wander in the wilderness 40 years until the whole generation that had done what was evil in the Lord's sight was gone. And so, as this Ligonier article states, the symbolism here is the exile would last long enough for one generation of Jews to pass away. The bearing of the punishment was to last 40 years, and that's a generation. So all you guys there in Babylon who are in exile, you're not going to get back. If you die out in this generation, you're not going to see Jerusalem again. I think that's pretty good symbolism there. Albert Barnes has got another take on it. He says that the 40 years indeed represents Israel's sojourn in the wilderness on the Exodus, but the purpose of that sojourn in the wilderness for 40 years was chastisement of the Jews with a goal of recovery. And so northern Israel is seen to suffer longer than the 40 years, 390 years. Their punishment is longer without hope of recovery. But the 40 years of punishment for Judah shows that the southern nation is going to recover in a way that the northern Israelites never did recover after their 722 exile at the hand of the Assyrians. Ellicott has a comment on the differences in the lengths of punishment, 390 compared to 40. Quote, the great disproportion between the two is in accordance with the difference in the two parts of the nation and the consequent divine dealings with them. Judah had remained faithful to its appointed rulers of the house of David, several of whose kings had been eminently devout men, through whatever mixture with idolatry it had yet always retained the worship of Yahweh, and had kept up the Aaronic priesthood, and preserved with more or less respect the law of Moses. Well, in my humble opinion, that's being a little bit charitable toward the Jews of Judah, but that's what Ellicott says. Continuing with Ellicott, it was now entering upon the period of the Babylonish captivity, from which after 70 years a remnant was to be again restored to keep up the people of the Messiah. Israel, on the other hand, had set up a succession of dynasties, and not one of all their kings had been a God-fearing man. They had made Baal their national god, and had made priest at their pleasure of the lowest of the people, and in consequence of their sins had been carried into a captivity from which they never returned. So that would at least explain the disproportionate punishment for northern Israel compared to southern Israel, even if the actual numbers, the meaning of those actual numbers, is a little bit hard to discern. So we move now to Ezekiel 4, verses 7 through 8. Yahweh continues to speak to Ezekiel. Turn your face toward the siege of Jerusalem, and with bared arm prophesy against her. I will tie you up with ropes, so that you cannot turn from one side to the other until you have finished the days of your siege. Now Ezekiel is going to be 390 years on his left, and 40 days on his right. And I failed to mention why left and why right. So let's go back up to verse 4 and take a look at that. That's where Ezekiel's told to lie on his left and his right. Why to lie on his left to represent 390 days of judgment on the northern kingdom of Israel? Well, the Orientals look to the east when describing the points of the compass, as Ellicott points out. So if you look to the east from Jerusalem, or from Babylon for that matter, where is Israel going to be? Northern Israel is going to be to the north, the northern 10 tribes. So the 10 tribes would be to one's left. And then if you're looking east, the two tribes would be south to your right. Now, other people have tried to read some more into this by saying that the left hand is less honorable than the right, which is true according to ancient notions, even according to modern notions for that matter. And so the point would be that Israel and its capital of Samaria were less honorable than Judah and its capital of Jerusalem. I don't think so. Maybe so. I don't know. But now, returning to verse 7, we see that Ezekiel is to turn his face toward the siege of Jerusalem. In other words, the siege that was written on the, or drawn on the clay brick or the clay tablet. So no matter whether Ezekiel is lying on his left side or his right side, Ezekiel's face was always to be towards Jerusalem. That would show the determination of the Babylonians to take the city. Remember, Jeremiah is to quote-unquote prophesy by his actions as well as his words. If he's lying there staring at the city for all those days, 390 plus 40, that means, by golly, I, representing the Babylonians, am going to take this city. Now, he's supposed to have a bare arm as he's lying facing the city. It was usual in those times to fight with a bare arm so that weapons could be handled better if they were wearing a long oriental garment that would have hindered the action of the sword-carrying arm. So that symbolizes that the Babylonians are ready for battle, that bared arm. And then Ezekiel in verse 7 is told to prophesy against Jerusalem, not necessarily in words, but by using all these actions, bearing his arm, turning his face toward Jerusalem. In verse 8, God says, I will tie you up with ropes so that you cannot turn from one side to the other until you have finished the days of your siege. Now, what's the symbolism of the tied up ropes? Option number 1, to show that Jews would be tied up and taken captive. Option number 2, to show that God would not let Babylonians deviate from their purpose. It could be both. The ropes show that Jews are going to be taken captive, and also that the Babylonians would be tied down such that they could not deviate from their divine purpose of whacking the city of Jerusalem and the land of Judah. Now, this tying of Ezekiel with ropes is in response to what God has already told Ezekiel would be done to him. We read in Ezekiel 3:25 in the previous chapter, And you, son of man, they will put ropes on you and bind you with them so you cannot go out among them. They there is the Jewish captives. So we can take from that in verse 8, when God tells Ezekiel, I will tie you up, what he means is I will use the Jews in exile to tie you up. Obviously, God's not going to come down and tie Ezekiel up spiritually. He's going to use the captive Jews, and they're going to tie Ezekiel up. Now, this situation of Ezekiel creates a problem for the view that Ezekiel only prophesied during the daytime and did not lie on his side at night. I speculate that these Jews in exile untied Ezekiel at night. It would be cruel beyond measure not to untie him at night. Ezekiel would have soiled his own garments. I would think even exiles who didn't like Ezekiel's prophecies, they would never be that cruel. And besides, Ezekiel would have to be untied periodically. We read in verse 9, the next verse, which I'll read for you in a minute, that Ezekiel could make bread, and he had to eat every day. How could he do that if he was tied up on his side? He had to measure out wheat. He had to cook. He did that at night. And besides, the whole purpose of this prophecy is an object lesson for the Jewish leaders. They would come in and they would see him during the day. They would not see Ezekiel during the night. And so that's why Ezekiel is tied up during the day. So ironically, the Jewish leaders who are trying to keep him to go outside during the day to prophesy to the people, they themselves are seeing the symbolism of the prophet as they tie him up every day. We go now to Ezekiel 4, verses 9 through 13. God continues to speak to Ezekiel. Also take wheat, barley, beans, lentils, millet, and spelt. Put them in a single container and make them into bread for yourself. You are to eat it during the number of days you lie on your side, 390 days. The food you eat each day will be 8 ounces by weight. You will eat it from time to time. You are also to drink water by measure, a sixth of a gallon, which you will drink from time to time. You will eat it as you would a barley cake and bake it over dried human excrement in their sight. The Lord said, This is how the Israelites will eat their bread, ceremonially unclean, among the nations where I will banish them. Well, let's first of all explain this strange commandment to eat wheat, barley, beans, lentils, millet, and spelt. Mix them all together and put them in a spelt. Mix them all together and put them in a single container in order to make some kind of bread out of that. Wheat was the only grain of those listed that humans ate in normal times. Barley, which was listed, was eaten in times of scarcity, and beans, lentils, millet, and spelt were all used for animals. The symbolic purpose of this is to show the extreme deprivation the Jews were about to be put to in 586. Remember, this is about 592 or 591 that Ezekiel is prophesying. Now, millet, according to Answers.com, is an annual grass cultivated in Eurasia for its grains and in North America for hay, some kind of hay. Spelt is a hardy wheat grown mostly in Europe. So these are all grain products. Lentils, you know what lentils are. I hope you do. Lentil soup. Beans, you know what those are. But basically it's horse food, as long as with a little bit of human food. Mix it all together, and that's what you're going to eat for 390 days. Now that's hard, but that's not impossible. You can survive doing that. Now, no mention is made of Ezekiel being requested to eat that common food for 40 days, the 40 days when he was on his right side. Well, it could be that it's just understood that the same actions would be done during the 40 days. It could be that Yahweh mentions the 390 days in particular because Israel was more degraded than Judah, as Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown suggest. Or, as some scholars say, the 40 days were included in the 390. I don't take that view, at least right now, in my stage of ignorance. I think the easiest thing to say is it's just not mentioned. But we can assume that Ezekiel's going to do the same thing on his right side for 40 days that he did on his left side for 390 days. Verse 10, the food you eat each day. Now, the food that Ezekiel is to eat each day could be eaten more than once a day, or it could only be eaten once a day, a loaf for each day. John Gill holds that view, and I think so, because we're going to see that the loaf is so small that why divide it up? Ezekiel must have lost a lot of weight on this diet. The food you eat each day will be 8 ounces by weight. I'm using the Holman Christian Study Bible here for all these measurements because they, in translating that version, they use English measures, which I'm more familiar with. The NIV footnote says that 8 ounces is 0.2 kilograms for all of you who are used to the metric system. That's not a lot. That's a small loaf, very little bread. And you're going to eat those 8 ounces by weight. In other words, the grain is going to be so scarce you've got to measure it out, down to the last ounce. To eat bread by weight was a sign of a grievous famine. That's his solid food. How about what he's going to drink? Verse 11, you are also to drink water, just water, no wine, by measure. A sixth of a gallon. Well, a sixth of a gallon is not very much. Two-thirds of a quart, that's not a lot of water. 0.6 liters, as the NIV footnote has it, two-thirds of a quart. The water, like the bread, is to be consumed by measure, as verse 11 says. If you have to measure out your water each day, that means you are really, really short. Bread and water, that's the iconic meal that prisoners get. Bread and water. In verse 12, God tells Ezekiel, you will eat it as you would a barley cake. Now, it's not a barley cake that's being eaten. Barley was just a portion of the contents of this cheap bread. So it wasn't actually a barley cake. It just looked like one. And to top it all off, this cheap bread was to be baked over dried human excrement. Human dung. Now that, of course, indicates an extreme famine. All of this is to show that the Jews, under siege by the Babylonians in just a few years, were going to be starving to death. Extreme famine. There's no fuel. No way to get the wood. No way to go outside the walls of the city of Jerusalem and chop trees. And eating food cooked over human dung would make the food nauseating. John Gill even says the dung was dried and wrapped around the food and baked, which I don't believe. Either does Adam Clark. He says, when we know that this did not come in contact with the bread, the dung, and was only used to warm the plate on which the bread was laid over the fire, it removes all the horror and much of the disgust. Well, I think Clark's got a point. Cooking over human dung is unpleasant, but it's not like it's going to kill you. I was, upon reading this, surprised that human excrement can burn, so I looked up some stuff on the internet and found something from Stanford University in California. Quote, excrement isn't a fuel you can simply just burn because it's mostly water. Drying and burning it is possible, but the varied composition of feces will cause poor combustion and numerous emissions. Well, fortunately for Ezekiel, God relented on that requirement and he didn't have to cook his food over human excrement. Now, one little detail at the end of verse 12 I need to deal with. God tells Ezekiel that you will eat as you would a barley cake and bake it over dried human excrement in their sight. Well, I previously presented a theory that the Jewish people left Ezekiel alone at night and they tied him up during the daytime. Well, here it appears that Ezekiel is cooking in their sight. Obviously, he's not cooking while he's tied up, so this would be at night in their sight. Well, if it's true that the elders of the Jews were watching Ezekiel cook the food at night, we've got a little problem. Here's some possible solutions. These are mine. Take them with a grain of salt. The in their sight goes with eating, not baking the bread. So eat the bread in their sight. Ezekiel would bake the bread at night by himself. I assume that someone would hand Ezekiel the bread as he's lying on his side, or either that Ezekiel, after he cooked the bread at night, would place the bread by his head as he was tied up each day. Another way to look at this is that the Jewish exiles, the leaders thereof, hung around long enough to watch Ezekiel cook at night, and then they left. So it's a minor problem. Now in verse 13, the Lord said, "This is how the Israelites will eat their bread." John Gill says this refers to all the Jews, not just the ones of the two tribes. I don't see how that's possible, because this is all talking about the siege of Jerusalem. We see in verse 13 the reason that the bread was to be cooked over human excrement. It was to make it ceremonially unclean, which would symbolize the fact that the Israelites in their captivity would have to eat their bread ceremonially unclean among the nations. They could not keep the kosher laws or the Levitical laws as they were in exile. And so the Jews in exile would lose their distinctiveness. We go now to Ezekiel 4, verses 14 through 17, and we will finish this chapter. Ezekiel responds to God. "Then I said, 'Not so, sovereign Lord. I have never defiled myself. From my youth until now, I have never eaten anything found dead or torn by wild animals. No unclean meat has ever entered my mouth.' 'Very well,' he," that's Yahweh, "said, 'I will let you bake your bread over cow manure instead of human excrement.' He," that's Yahweh, "then said to me, Ezekiel, 'Son of man, I will cut off the supply of food in Jerusalem. The people will eat rationed food in anxiety and drink rationed water in despair. For food and water will be scarce. They will be appalled at the sight of each other and will waste away because of their sin.'" Now, Ezekiel, as a priest, remember in verse 14, he exclaims in horror about that human dung that he's supposed to cook his bread over. He says, "I've never found anything dead and eaten it, or anything torn by wild animals." Those, of course, were specifically mentioned in the laws, the Levitical laws, as being unclean. "No unclean meat has ever entered my mouth," Ezekiel says, and God relents and says, "Okay, use cow manure instead." Now, there's nothing in the law, I don't think, not that I know of, that says if you cook your food over human excrement, the food becomes unclean. It was probably not in the law because nobody would ever think about doing that. And there's nothing wrong with cooking food over cow manure, of course. At least I don't think so. By switching to cow manure instead of to human manure, it could be that the food is no longer considered unclean, so Ezekiel could eat it, and that would lose a little bit of the object lesson that the Jews would be eating unclean food while they are in captivity. Now, ironically enough, in the actual siege, the Jews were forced to use human excrement, says one of my commentators. But in the object lesson, in the visual prophecy, Ezekiel, as a priest, didn't have to do that. He would be especially loath to use human excrement. He had the same reaction that Peter did when in Acts chapter 10, Peter was told to eat unclean animals in his dream. "No, no, no, not going to do that, God." I mean, that's pretty hard to talk back to God, but that's a terrible thing for a priest to have to be involved with such yuckiness. I'm not a Levitical priest, and the thought of eating food cooked over human manure does not especially appeal to me either. Now, the chapter is finished off by God just saying it's going to be bad for the people in Jerusalem. There's going to be famine. I guess God is explaining the meaning of the visual prophecy that Jeremiah is to give, eating measured grain and measured water in such small quantities for that time. God just explains it to Ezekiel. When Jerusalem goes down, boy, they're going to be hungry and they're going to be thirsty. They will be appalled at the sight of each other and will waste away. They're going to look like skeletons, blackened in their faces, staggering around in the sunshine with no water. Ladies and gentlemen, on that austere note, we are now finished with Ezekiel chapter 4, and we are prepared now to go to the next chapter of Ezekiel, Ezekiel 5, which I will entitle Jerusalem Will Be Destroyed. I hope you stay tuned for those mournful events in our next audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.